Wait, didn't you say give an altar?
Robert Bick.
Hey y'all, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Kat and I'm an alcoholic. I'm welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm Tim, I'm an alcoholic. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, our speaker, Wayne M., he's one of those guys that has to say, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. He came back into the rooms in 2012. I'm not so well aware of what happened before that time, and I'm looking forward to hearing his story tonight. He's one of the few people that confront me after the meeting and say that they'd like to tell their story and actually show up for it. So congratulations, Wayne. Please come up and take over.
Thank you. I'm really glad he left the promises up here so I can refer to them as I talk, because I've got CRS. Can't remember stuff. And if there are sensibilities that I that you have a problem with my talk, please see me after the meeting. Keep coming back. I like Frank. He's a rebel. I know him already. I love it. I have this idea that doing it my way is better. So it took me a long time, mostly slowly, to show up here and be part of y'all. I was born in Tucson, Arizona, raised in Phoenix, Arizona, and grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona. And there was about a 35-year difference between being born and growing up. What brought me to that growing up experience was pain, going through a divorce. I had lots and lots of help at that time. Primary care physicians suggested that I get some counseling. So I did. And the counselor suggested I go to Al-Anon. So I did. I didn't learn how to kick and scream yet. So I did what was put in front of me. That period of time, let me start back. When I was 18 years old, we had a senior high school party. And that was the first time I did some blackout drinking. My stepbrother remembers that well. It has been a story we have told through many, many decades, many years, around the family Christmas dinner table or the Thanksgiving table. There was Bacardi. There was lots and lots of scotch. There was whiskey. There was wine. There was beer. And there was chocolate cake. And I had a whole bunch of all of that. And at that time, my stepbrother slept, we were in bunk beds. He slept underneath me. And somehow I managed to crawl up into that top bunk. And he will never let me forget how he had to wake up to the aftermath of my drinking. And that's a good thing. He won't let me forget. When I was 16, my mother passed away. And my dad remarried pretty shortly, and she had three kids. And those three kids, one of them has passed away. They say it was from a brain aneurysm, and I know it was from mixing whiskey and oxycodone. And you don't read about that in the newspapers. You don't read about the problems this society has today. I'm just going to keep bouncing around and see what comes out. One of the deals was when they remarried, was there were five kids in the house then. And so I didn't get what I thought I needed. And so as soon as I turned 18, I was on the road. I hit the road. And I carried a resentment towards my stepmom and everybody else around me at that time, but mostly towards my stepmom. I'll talk about that. That was when I was 18 and 19. And I got introduced to pot, got introduced to truck driver's medicine, White Crosses, and I got introduced to alcohol in a big way. And that started a pattern of running for me. And how I like to term it, I was running on empty, pedal to the metal, running on empty. So a little bit of this drug here, a little bit of peppermint schnapps there, a little bit of pot here, and motorcycles. And boy, that was my way of life for about 15 years. From about 20 till when I was about 35. And so I'm a periodic drunk and a periodic user of whatever. When I was about 35, my wife at the time and I decided we wanted to have kids. We've been married for about 7 or 8 years. We want to have kids. And so she went to, when we couldn't have kids, she went to the doc. And she was fine. I was sure it was her fault. Listen to that blame. It was her fault that we couldn't have kids. And it wasn't. And I had just gotten back from a long motorcycle journey up to Wisconsin. And had prostatitis, which is inflammation of the prostate. In other words, it hurt. And so I went to see the doc. And what he told me later, after all these tests and everything, Wayne, there's lots and lots of men in this world that can ride motorcycles, smoke pot, and you're not one of them. I didn't tell him about all the other stuff. So it took another 10 years probably. Yeah, another 10 years before I was willing to give up the peppermint schnapps. But the pot I gave up right away, and the speed I gave up right away, and thank God they did not have the kind of drugs out there that they have today. You know, I managed to make it through high school relatively clean and sober, and I'm real grateful that that kind of, my learning through high school stuck with me. As I gave up the pot, I started to have this experience. I had this spiritual experience and didn't know what it was, had trouble remembering it, and eventually it came back to me. A year later, my daughter was born. She is 34 years old now. She lives here in Atlanta, and my reason for being here, among other things, is to make a living amends to her, and that's working out well. We got into counseling about a month ago to sort out stuff because she really needed a safe place to confront Dad and tell him it was not working for her. And it took me that long in recovery, in counseling, in every other thing I've been doing. I've been a seeker for a long time, as far back as I can remember. At first, I labeled it looking for love in all the wrong places. And that's another part of my dis-ease. And so, over time, well, I got sober in 1990, the first time. And I was asked to... Now, let me step that back a little bit. Through that divorce... I started getting into counseling, and I started looking around for love in all the wrong places. And what showed up, the only singles group in Flagstaff was at a church, a Baptist church. And so I started showing up at their singles group, and the girls started saying, "We don't see you at church, Wayne, you know, what's the deal?" And so I started, you know, they suggested I start coming to church, and I started showing up there. And what kept me coming back there was the music. Eventually, Glenn Campbell joined that same church. That's a side note. So the music started to reach me, and that's been throughout my life. And as I started going to church, they asked me to, or they, I don't know if they asked me or not. I showed up at a choral during Christmas, a group of people who went around and sang to different houses and different blocks and different communities. And that was the first time that, that those Christmas songs made sense to me. You know, I'd always sung them, but they didn't make sense. And so slowly but surely, that message that God gives all of us started to show up, started to percolate from up here to down here. Left Flagstaff, went because it wasn't big enough. They didn't have enough ladies there that were dateable. And Flagstaff's a pretty big town. University there and everything else. So I went to Tucson, back home, back to Tucson, and met my next wife in Tucson. And I also started going to a Methodist church there, and I got invited to a spiritual growth group, and they had a teacher. And one of the, and this teacher liked to give orders to everybody in the group. And one of the orders was, Wayne, you go to this meeting, and whether you're an alcoholic or not, you go to AA meeting, because that's where the long-term sobriety is. And, oh, yeah, I've read the big book. I got all that figured out. And I did what the teacher suggested, or ordered, however you want to put it. And that started my journey in AA. And that was in 1989. In about 2000, big jump there, but I kept going to a whole lot of other, went to one other 12-step recovery group, and I picked up a 20-year chip in it, and I kept going to AA. And then I moved. I retired from a job I'd had for 22 years and left a house that I was in love with, left my AA community and my other community, church community, and moved up to Oregon, Roseburg, Oregon. Beautiful place. I got busy moving. I got busy figuring out the next house. I got busy taking care of the land there. Started resting on my laurels. You know, I'm retired. I deserve to rest. I deserve to quit reading some kind of recovery literature. I deserve to sit in front of the TV and veg out. What we got was a couple of Australian shepherds, and those dogs kept me off the couch for quite a while, because if I didn't take them out and exercise them, they would redecorate the house, and that was awful. So that resting on my laurels and not connecting with meetings again, and the next deal was back to that prostate stuff. I got prostate cancer. And so the doc said, well, do this, this, or this. And I said, okay. And I got the surgery, and I got clean from it, you know, about a month later. They told me everything's clear. And so on the way home from Eugene, which is the capital of Oregon, it's about a 7-mile drive to home, I started thinking, well, I need to celebrate this. You know, this is great news. I need to celebrate. So what came to mind was picking up a 6-pack on the way home. That's when I got home, that's when I decided I needed to get my butt back into meetings again and get another sponsor. And that's what I did in Roseburg. And the only meetings that had any kind of attendance were AA meetings. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So finally, I was willing to surrender to the recovery. I was willing to surrender everything. So my wake-up call, my moment of clarity, was not being in jail. My moment of clarity was not losing everything at that time. So I started going to meetings, and I started reading the big book again, and I started reading our literature again, and I started getting more honest. So this is after 12 or 13 years, I guess, from when I was first introduced to AA and started going and stayed clean and sober to when I went back out. So I knew, I had this intellectual knowledge of what I should do. And that was not enough. I had all this counseling, and that was not enough. I had all this book knowledge, and that was not enough to keep me from going back to old ideas and old ways of doing things. And it, you know, it didn't matter whether I was wanting to celebrate or I didn't feel good, or I was too tired from working and a cold beer would taste good. It didn't matter what was in front of me. I became looking for that next high, that next drink, that next buzz. And it's out there. There is a 30 or 40 or 100 mile an hour wind out there today. And AA is very different today than it was 75 years ago. There are problems that I have other than alcohol. Big Book says alcohol is but a symptom. And that's true. There's all those last three little letters after alcohol. It's the ism. And that's what keeps me coming back. Bill W. writes about emotional sobriety. That is so important. So it's not just putting down the drink. It's also about showing up here, helping others, cleaning house. There's a long list of stuff that that works. And if I rest on my laurels, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much time I have in. It doesn't matter how well my life is going. Just doesn't matter. I have to keep coming back. It is so easy to get sideways, because there are always going to be situations that affect my emotional sobriety. And that's a big deal for me today. Because when I lose that, when I hang on to resentments, then my life quits working. Step one, admitted we are powerless. So it's not just alcohol that I'm powerless over. It's also those basic instincts that God gave me. I'm powerless over how I grew up. I'm powerless over the people in my life. Let me do a little segue there. I'm powerless over the people in my life. So one of the things that I had to do was learn how to change my talk in order to be present here with y'all. And I had to drop the question, why? Especially with partner. You know, why didn't you take out the garbage? Why didn't you do the dishes? Why didn't you blah, blah, blah? And that leads to anger and resentments. So I had to drop why from my language. So talk matters. What I say matters. And I learned how to change my talk here in these meetings. One of the big deals that I'm recovering from is shame. And that fear of not being okay. You know, the in and of myself, I'm not okay. And that's shame. And that gets passed on generation to generation, just like alcoholism gets passed on. One of the and I'm powerless over carrying resentments. There was about a 30-year difference, 30-year space of time from when I did my first fourth step to when I finally got complete with my stepmom. And how that happened was, I was up in Blairsville 8 months ago watching a movie, From Hell to High Water. And one of the characters said, poverty is a disease. It gets passed on generation to generation. And West Texas was the setting for that movie. And my stepmom was from West Texas. So when her and my dad got married, what she did was make sure that her kids would not live in poverty. And I didn't see that at the time. So I was pissed off at her for 40-something years. Through all kinds of counseling and therapy and fourth steps and all that stuff, I didn't get it until about 8 months ago. Made a huge difference for me to learn how to forgive her, for me to have compassion for her. And she's in a rest home. She's in managed care. So it didn't make any difference to her whether or not I forgave her. It made a difference to me. I think that resentments are like little black holes. They follow us around and swallow up all the joy, all the compassion, all that freedom of being that happens. So when I walked out of that theater and the tears were just rolling, I had a sense of finally being free. And that's after a long time in these rooms and a long time doing other things, being the seeker, looking for knowledge, looking for spirituality. One of the things that has made a huge difference for me recently, and that's the deal. This program always gives me the next thing. You know, life always gives me the next opportunity. And if I can let go of my resentments about my experience, if I can give up those resentments, let them go, yo, God, please take this resentment from me, then the miracles happen. Now let's see, which way do we go? Ah, the promises. We read these at every meeting. How am I doing on time, by the way? Okay. We read these promises at every meeting. And there are verbs all the way through here. And one of the things that's so important for me today is to start paying attention to what's going on in here. God is not out there on a mountaintop someplace. Higher power is not in a book someplace. I can't memorize the big book and heal my heart. It doesn't happen that way. What happens is I have a spiritual awakening. It starts with a moment of clarity. And it continues if I let it, if I keep showing up, if I give up the resentments about my experience. The lessons that I learn, where is this spirituality? How does that happen? It happens in the now, right here, right now. That's as good as it gets. And when I can be present for that, then the miracle occurs. And it's not like I have to do anything. It's not like I deserve. It's not like the knowledge, if I have this, if I can figure things out, then maybe the miracle will occur. That's not the deal. Let me read the verbs from the promises. We will be amazed. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past. We will comprehend. We will know. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Is that something like, I'll take it out and it'll go away? We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest. How in the heck does that happen? Self-seeking will slip away. My attitude will change. My outlook upon life will change. Fear of people will leave us. Economic insecurity will leave us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us. All of that stuff is it's like it's just given to us. When I can keep showing up and keep practicing the principles, which are the steps, when I can keep taking when I can keep taking the steps, Frank, rather than working them, I like that distinction. That is so important. Working them, to me, implies that it's a knowledge-based thing. If I work harder, then I'll be okay. It's not that. It's those steps end up from up here to here. Learning compassion. I learned compassion from having hidden bottom and recognizing that I'm part of the group here. That I'm okay. That y'all will support me. That y'all have a lot of wisdom. That it's not just me doing this. I belong. And that's one of the big recovery parts for me. Because I always felt on the outside looking in. You know, I was always not part of the group. And so I would drink in order to fit in. I'd smoke pot in order to fit in. I rode motorcycles in order to prove that, you know, I was a real man. I don't have to do that anymore. You know, I used to have these old ideas about what it meant to be a man. And I learned all that from TV, watching TV when I was a kid. Real men solve their problems out in the middle of the street, 40 feet away, with guns. Real men don't need no stinking help. I can do this all on my own. And what's true is these promises don't show up until I surrender. And that's part of the paradox of this program. And those paradoxes show up throughout our reading. I can't keep what I have unless I give it away. I can't win until I surrender. Those are scattered all throughout our book. Spirituality. Well, let's see. Let me look at the steps one time.
And see if I can make sense of that. Yeah, after the inventory.
After my inventory. Which occurs pretty frequently now. I used to think that I was in charge of my character defects. That if I only tried harder, if I only went to more meetings, if I only figured things out better, then maybe I wouldn't have character defects. Doesn't work that way. What I have learned in this program is that if I want my character defects removed, I humbly, that's a big word, I humbly ask God to remove them. And He does the deal. He does the job. And it's the same way with those promises. All of those promises, all of those spiritual verbs, that's in the spiritual world. And I've tried to solve my problems in the material world. You know, maybe if I get more money, maybe if I get the right house, maybe if I get the right new truck or the new motorcycle, you know, maybe then I'll be okay. Doesn't work that way. What was so important for me was to take these steps and have a spiritual awakening and enter the world of the Spirit. And Bill talks about that. Right after the promises, we have now entered the world of the Spirit. And the only way that I can keep track of that, the only way I could be with that is to keep showing up here and y'all teach me. Let's see. Step 10. Let's go there. Continue to take personal inventory. You know, just before step 10 is we have now entered the world of the Spirit. And step 10 says continue to take personal inventory. And the inventory that I need to take is whether or not I'm in that spiritual world. You know, am I still trying to figure out my solutions and the solutions to my life in the material world? That more money will fix this problem. Or a new motorcycle will fix this problem. No. The solution is in the spiritual world. And 11, step 11, continue to seek. I've been a seeker for a long time. There are so many places throughout many, many centuries that the solution appears in many different forms. So I've learned how to translate the Baptist language into the Methodist language, into 12-step language, into psychological terms. It's all the same. And so I keep learning and I keep reading, and that's what keeps me coming back here also. And step 12, carrying the message. I am so honored and so grateful to be here, to be giving this talk. In the 7:30 morning meeting, they say, they sing. I've never ever been in a meeting where they sing. They sing Getting to Know You. And that's why I'm so grateful. You know, as I get to know you and I can be here present. When I first stood up, there's a little scared. I was a little scared, a little worried, a little this, a little that. When I can talk about that, then I can be here without the resentments, without the fears, without the other stuff going on. And that's what brings me back into the present. When I can share what I've learned with others, I can talk with another alcoholic. That's being in the present. And I can tell you what's going on in my life with a modicum of honesty. It took a long time to learn that one. And that came through learning humble. When I had the beer, showed up at AA meeting again, got a sponsor, started working the steps. I was involved in one meeting and became the home group, and I sounded really good in that meeting. Boy, I was just shining. They wanted me to take over the business part. It's a small meeting, so there's the treasurer, and you show up with a key every twice a week. And in order to take over the leadership of the meeting, I'll put quotes around leadership, they wanted to know how much sobriety I had. And by that time, I had learned a little bit of honesty. And I said, well, 6 months? Oh, no, you got to have more than 6 months. And so they had to have a group conscience. And they still wanted me to do the deal. But having to admit, after going to that meeting for 6 months and trying to look good, that's one of my biggest character defects, I had to admit that, you know, I've only had 6 months of sobriety. And I also learned there the humbleness part of my recovery. And it's only been in recent times that I've been willing to say, this is my home group. I've been willing to admit, you know, I don't have 30 years of sobriety. I've been willing to admit that, you know, sometimes I'm scared. Sometimes my life doesn't work. How am I doing on time? No, I mean, I've got another story to tell, and...
Can you do that in 2 or 3 minutes?
Okay. Okay. What brought me here was a divorce. Actually, it was a restraining order brought me here. Do you hear the honesty coming out a little bit? Hopefully it'll be a divorce in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. April 13th. So a restraining order brought me here. I had the carpet jerked out from underneath me in Roseburg. And when I left, I had my car and my tools and the shirt on my back. And I, my stepbrother called me up. You know, I'd found a hotel in town, and then I moved in with a buddy for about a month. And then my stepbrother called. He said, why don't you come down? He didn't know anything about the separation. Why don't you come down and help us put Mom in a managed care facility? And by that time, I had gotten, I needed to start doing what was put in front of me, because I didn't know what else to do. So I went. I started a journey south to Phoenix. It's about 1,000 miles. When I landed there, I got into meetings, and one of the gentlemen in the meetings said, you're going to Atlanta? Here's a business card. Look him up when you get there. And the gentleman I looked up had 30 years of sobriety, took me under his arm, led me around town. Of course, there was that Blairsville movie that helped me sort out the resentment I'd been carrying for 40 years. All across the country, there are all these circumstances that showed up, these wonderful miracles, coincidences that happened when I did what was put in front of me. I had to stop and buy a couple of buckets when I left Phoenix to get here because I was filling up the car with tears. You know, I would listen to a recovery CD and then I'd listen to country music. And so the tears would just roll and I'd hear the message and I'd surrender again. And that's what my life has been today, is learning how to surrender over and over and over again, do what's put in front of me, and just say, okay. So thank you all.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your story. Let's see, we have asked Robert to come and give out the chips.
Thanks, Kat. My name's Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been asked to give out the chips. And thank goodness the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And we give out the white chip if you've got a desire to stop drinking or if you're coming back. So anybody that needs or wants to get a white chip? You? Come on up. Anyone else? After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anyone have 30 days?
All right.
Here we go. Anyone with 90 days? Red chip. No red chip. Okay. After 6 months, we have a yellow chip. Anyone have 6 months? After 9 months, we have a green chip. Do we have anyone celebrating a birthday that we don't know about? If not, Jim, come on up. I've got a chip for Jim. Jim's sobriety date is March 20th, 2003, and I've known him essentially that long. And, you know, when you know somebody for a long time, you've stayed sober for a long time. I know I've been through a lot since 2003, and Jim's been through a lot since 2003, and we've been able to stay sober that long. And, you know, that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, is we get to come here, we get to learn to rely on God, we get to take the steps, we get to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and help other people. I'm just grateful that I know Jim as a sponsor, but more importantly as his friend. And so I'm really honored that I can give you this chip, Jim. Congratulations.
That would figure.
My name is Jim Stone, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
I came here tonight for one great big reason. As that was 30 years ago when I came to Atlanta to get sober. This was the first AA meeting I went to. The Monday night speakers meeting in that. And it has not changed. I get the same feeling I got then when I walked through the door. I was able to stay sober for 13 years. And then I relapsed. It was probably one of the best things that could have happened to me, because I had wandered so far away from the program in my arrogance and complacency, and I got this thing. I'll be okay. Y'all ever think that? What are you about to do?
Oh, I'm just sneaking up on you. I'm trying to catch this.
Whoa. I got forward real good. Backwards didn't work real well. And then about a year ago, I found out I had cancer. But it's going along real well. And I decided I was going to go through it sober. And so far, that's happened. No help other than what they give me. But that was the reason I came here, because I felt like it was appropriate at this time. Don't tell me why. I think like an alcoholic. To come back here to get this chip. And I'm not sure how I did it other than just one day at a time. What I found from the relapse was that relapse isn't the end of everything. It's an opportunity for a better beginning. I've seen so many people relapse and we never see them again. I have great admiration for those people who can do that and walk back in these rooms and pick up a white chip, just like I did. Because it really is an opportunity for a better beginning. And so far that's worked out for me for 14 years. And the help of a young man sitting behind me who became someone so important to me I can't describe it. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for so much for letting me do this here. God bless all of you. And thank you.
Thanks, Jim. And anyone want to reconsider on the white chip? If not, congratulations on the chip you got.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Take the air.